Everyone knows Marty Lee, or Heinous if you really know him from back in the day. He's that guy from Erie who plays guitar for Donny Iris and the Cruisers. But of course, he had years of honing his chops before he landed that gig. He played in the very popular Red, White, and Blueberry, and then in bands like Reel to Reel, the Fabulous Nobodies, and eventually The Pulse, which led him to meeting Donny. I interviewed Marty years ago for my book on the Erie County Fieldhouse and a subsequent blog that I wrote in 2015. Each time, he's been super accommodating and patient with me, and I appreciate him taking the time to chat with me. So, here's episode 29 featuring Marty Heinous, or Lee, whichever you prefer. All right, Marty Heinous, welcome to the Erie Music History Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for talking to me again. We talked way back in 2015, and we probably talked back in 2012 when I wrote my book about the Fieldhouse. You were gracious enough to give me some good quotes for that, talking about your time with Donny playing at the Fieldhouse. But you also, and we're going to cover this today, you played at the Fieldhouse a few other times with Red, White, and Blueberry.
Yeah, that's right.
So now, am I correct in saying you still live in, is it North Canton, Ohio, somewhere around there?
I do. And I also, I don't work in North Canton. So okay. I keep an apartment near where I work and I shuffle back and forth between those places.
Still doing graphic design?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. And do you have your own business still or?
No, I don't. You know, I like to design, and this might make some sense. I like to design CDs and albums, all the artwork for that. And I do it for a lot of my friends. And I have for years. And so I do that not really as a business.
Sure.
But to help out, you know, because I, you know, because I can.
You used to do all the stuff for Michael Stanley, right?
Yeah, I did. For years, I did all Michael's stuff, including his last one.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. It was a pleasure to work with.
Did you ever play with him or just knew him from?
We never played a show together in the same band, but our two bands, Donny Iris Band and Michael Stanley Band, were linked by way of our management company, which is the Belkin organization. So we sort of were all part of the same family.
Mm-hmm.
And so we played lots and lots of shows together. And the two bands in, I'm not sure the year, might be 83. We set the, I'll have to look up the date, but we set the record at Blossom.
Right.
For four nights of shows. I'm not sure exactly what the number is, but for 4 days, we were somewhere in the 68,000 to 70,000 fans.
Wow.
I think that's still the record.
That's cool. Yeah. I remember obviously seeing you guys back in the 80s, and it seemed like you were either opening for them or vice versa, or, you know, they were on the same bill. And
yeah, well, anywhere around Ohio, we would open for them no matter what, because they were just, you know, this is their turf and well-earned.
Sure.
And we would travel maybe a bit more outside of the area and, you know, around the U.S. where we had fans in other places, and theirs tended to be, not exclusively, but tended to be in this region. Mm-hmm. So when we came in this region, they were the headliner, and, you know, that was fine. We had a great time.
Yeah.
I loved all those shows. We did lots of, more than I could count.
I'm sure. And I know that I'm going to be testing your memory today, so I apologize in advance. So,
well, I'll do my best.
All right. Well, so everybody seems to know a lot about you from obviously Donny Iris and the Cruisers and that part of your career. But today we're going to talk about what happened before that, back when you were growing up in Erie. Where'd you grow up?
I went to school in Northeast.
Okay.
And after graduating, I moved to Erie. I started attending Penn State Barron And I didn't stay there more than about a year. And then I worked full time and started playing music on the side. And then it kind of switched and I started doing music full time and still staying in Erie. And
take me all the way back when you first started playing. How old were you playing guitar?
First started playing guitar at all. I was probably 12.
I know eventually you take lessons from Ed Puton and you guys shack up together and live together for a little while, right?
That's right. Yeah.
But he wasn't your first teacher, I would imagine.
No. One of my first teachers was Pat Tallarico.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he used to teach out in the West Erie Plaza at Osiki Brothers Music. There was a music store there. Sure. They had a couple of stores in town. West Erie Plaza was one of them. And I'd go there and take lessons from Pat. I mean, not for a long time, but we did, but he was one of my first official teachers. And I think Ed came after that.
Okay.
And I took lessons from Basil Ronsetti. And I took lessons from Preston Lindy.
Oh, wow.
And those were my guitar teachers. And all those guys are really skilled and knowledgeable. Yeah. I don't know. I've lost track of pretty much all of them. I did see Pat a few years back. We played out in Phoenix and he came and we hung out the whole time I was there. And that was great fun. But Ed, you know, I know is still around, but we've lost track of each other as well.
Sure.
The other two guys, just once I left the Erie area, you know, I was not in touch with them at all.
Well, Basil and Preston, you know, a lot of folks, as well as with Ed, you know, attribute their guitar skills to those guys, you know, Basil especially, you know.
Yeah, just extremely. Wait, I mean, he had lots of knowledge that I wasn't able to take advantage of. I didn't have enough, I guess, there's enough raw material to work with for him because he really had the lots and lots of knowledge.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a guitar player. If I'm not mistaken, he just, you know, he was just a musically, you know, gifted. And so he decided to teach guitar player.
Right.
Whereas Preston definitely was a guitar player.
Sure.
Yeah.
Where was Basil teaching you at the time? Markham?
Oh, gosh.
Somewhere downtown. I can't
remember. But I can't remember where.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a lot of actually, you know, I didn't take a lot of lessons from any of them.
Okay.
But I got some knowledge from each of them. And, you know, I'm sure it's all relevant. So it's all in there somewhere.
And you and Pat must be pretty close in age, right?
We are, yeah.
Yeah, so you were taking lessons from a guy that was, you know, your age at the time.
Yeah, but Pat, you know, he had some skills, you know, and he was happy to share. He's very generous with all of that. And then, of course, and we'll get into this, you know, a few years after that, you know, and I was applying what he was showing me, and I played around. You know, there was an opportunity in Red, White, and Blueberry because they were in existence before I came along, for sure. Yeah. And then they had a lead guitarist named Bernie, but I can't remember Bernie's last name. But
DiNardo,
that's right. Yeah. And he left the band, and I got a shot to join the band. And it was great. That was a great, great thing to be a part of.
And, you know, we'll talk a lot about Red, White, and Blueberry today because that is a band that was super popular in the early 70s in Erie. A lot of people have fond memories of it.
Me too.
And, you know, yeah, I mean, everybody remembers you playing in that band. Was there bands before that for you?
Yeah, you know, I'm never going to remember all the bands, all the players in the bands.
Right.
But I had bands, you know, in my teen years, you know, I've started out on drums. I did play guitar, but my first bands, I was a drummer.
Okay.
And then the second band or bands or whatever, I played bass.
Okay.
And then the next sort of set of bands, you know, I could name these bands. No one would know them except the players in the bands. My first band was the Convicts with a K. I played drums.
Okay. All right. And then, you're how old? Like 12?
No, 12, 13, 14 years old.
Did the Convicts play anywhere?
Yeah. I mean, we played, you know, in Northeast at the American Legion and stuff like that. So the way it was, the two primary players in the band at the beginning were was my friend John Cunningham, who I've also lost touch with. And he and another fella named Danny Bagley, they played, they were a duo, sort of a Beatles folk duo, and they played in Northeast. And I saw them playing. I thought it was amazing. You know, that's all I remember. They were just amazing. And then I was working with my stepfather at his repair shop. He fixed cars. And I was working in, it was a summertime, and I remember, and I couldn't have been, I'm maybe 14. I'm sure I wasn't 15. And they came up to me, and I didn't really know them. And they said, the Ouija board said that you could play drums. So I lied, and I said, oh, yeah, I can play drums. And I couldn't.
Yeah.
No. So, I had played a little bit of snare drum in sixth grade, you know, but I had never played a drum set in my life. And they brought me over to their house where they had an old drum set that they had freshly painted. So to me, it looked like this amazing, awesome thing. And it was, you know, painted with a brush.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, awful. But I didn't know any different. And then they quickly realized that, yeah, I couldn't play them. I couldn't at all. But they kind of were in deep at that point. They kind of committed. So John decided to teach me. And and that was my first. So he taught me all the drum parts to all the songs that we were going to do. We played Beatles songs, and eventually I learned. And then I got myself my own drum set with my parents' help. And, you know, so again, we're talking like 14 years old. And then, as I said, I moved to bass, and then I started, I don't remember what the turning point was for me, but I wanted to play electric guitar. I'd only had acoustic up to that point.
Okay.
So I just started woodshedding, and probably from 16, 17, 18 years old, I was playing like more than, you know, a well-adjusted person should play. So I'll just say, I mean, it was nothing to play 8 to 10 hours a day, every day.
Wow.
Every chance I could get, I played.
And
high school, you know, I would just, I mean, I made time for some extracurriculars, but I mean, I was just playing and playing, playing privately. And then I would get into a band that would last for a little while.
Yeah.
And I, you know, just by doing that so much, what I did was, if this is interesting to you, I mean, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
I wanted to learn how to play songs by, you know, my guitar heroes like Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix and you know, Johnny Winter and all these players, but they played so fast. So I don't know where the idea came from or if I'd read about it or something, but I had a turntable and I took it to a repairman who fixed such things. And I said, you know, this thing plays at 33 RPM, but I want it to play at 16 RPM, and it didn't have a 16. So he set the belts so that it would play at half speed. And then that slowed all the parts down.
Right.
And of course they were, when you do that, the pitch also goes down an octave.
Sure.
But that allowed me to learn these parts. And that's what I did. So I played records at half the speed, learned the parts, and then gradually played them faster and that's how I taught myself a lot of what I play.
Sure.
Then as I took lessons from the guys we talked about before, you know, I could apply, I had some playing ability, and then I could apply more theory that they shared with me, and then those two things kind of combined. And
gotcha.
That's how that all happened.
You know, I've interviewed a bunch of folks for the podcast so far, but I've never had a Northeast grape picker on, you know, and
that's right, buddy.
And, you know, I always hear from those other folks, you know, that played in Erie, you know, hey, when I was young, we had the opportunity to do WICO and those types of things. Being in Northeast, you mentioned what, the American Legion or something like that. Were there other
places? We played at the American Legion. We played at the American Legion. We would play at maybe a high school event.
Yeah.
There was also a YMCA there. And I'm not sure if I was old enough to play at the time they were. Anyway, there that was another place to play. That was it, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
Of course, I was underage. I couldn't take gigs at bars, which I'm sure there were some of those.
Right.
Yeah, so that's how that went. You know, I just played around those kinds of things until I got a little bit older and I could go and play in some of the bars, and then I would do that with some bands.
And you eventually start teaching at Bowling's too, right? Like, how old were you then?
Oh, that was quite a bit later on.
Okay, all right.
I didn't teach till I'm sure I was in my 20s. I would have no business teaching before then, believe me. A lot of wrong notes along the way, and that's kind of how you get better, right? You just make mistakes and learn from them.
Sure.
I made lots.
Well, that's why you're practicing 6 to 8 hours a day, evidently.
Yeah, I did. It was kind of extreme.
So the convicts don't last long. You go in and out of some other bands.
You know, with friends, you know, right. good friends. And, you know, had a band called Fireworks with a fellow named John McLean and my dear friend, Mike Kuklis. And we were in another band called Eris. These are all, you know, maybe they last a year or something like that. You
right.
know, we'd had fun. We played, you know, around wherever we could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All covers? Were you doing any originals?
All covers.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so is Red, White, and Blueberry the first like big band that you join, or real successful band, I should say?
Unless I'm missing something in the timeline, I think they were.
Okay. All right. They started around 72, 73 with Bernie on lead guitar.
Okay.
But John Erickson was already there. Bert was there playing drums, all the drums.
Lots of drums.
Every drum there was available.
Lots of drums. That's right. Yep. Really
was Pat in the band already when you?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So that must have been pretty cool. Like you knew Pat. Is that how you got into the band?
Well, I'm sure, you know, and I don't know that we've ever talked about it, and maybe we did, and I've forgotten it. Maybe.
No, I don't think so.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know how I would have gotten in that band had I not known Pat, because I didn't know the other guys.
Okay. All right.
So you know. I don't remember another. I mean, I played in bands and, you know, I think I played pretty well, but, you know, maybe I'm missing something in my memory, but I think that was the first band. And it was a big step up from most of the bands in the year at the time in terms of like production.
Right.
You know, they had, you know, crew, you know, a truck, his PA system, lights, all that stuff. And John Erickson was, you know, really talented, you know, like technician.
Mm.
So he would build a lot of these devices that we would use.
Yeah, you guys did have quite a lot of devices from what I
built
understand.
Things. We had rotating big mirrors. And
what was that big mirror above?
Yeah,
Bert,
it's another one. I imagine it might have come from Bert's mind or John's, but
okay.
John could bring these things to life and it would rotate. It had a name on the one side, and then in the middle of the drum solo would flip around and it was mirrors, so you could it was a whole giant mirror and you could look down and see from the top down. You know, now we would do it with cameras and big screens, right? But at the time it was, you know, sort of a, you know, a version of that where you could see from a different angle. The audience could see Bert from the top.
Yeah. And, yeah. you know, that's what I heard about you guys is that, you know, you did have that crew, you know, you had Bruce Shampoo, right? And
yes.
Victor Lever on sound. Later, you had some other roadies, John DiNardo, Phil Thomas. I know they're yes. probably missing some guys, but I mean, it was a lot of stuff. It was a lot of lights. It was a lot of sound. And yeah. it was a spectacle, right?
To a certain extent, yeah, it was. We had sound and lights, and I don't remember. I mean, I think we had flashbots and fog and
yeah.
all that stuff, and we rolled, you know, a lot of it out and made a rock concert out of it, you know, and
right.
And so it was, you know, it was a real nice introduction to that whole kind of scene, you know, to the production on that level. Then, you know, subsequently, then I, you know, the other bands that I got into, which were really good musically, but, you know, didn't have that kind of production. It was a big, like you say, spectacle.
And you guys, you traveled, you did, you know, a lot of one-nighters, you did colleges, yeah. high schools.
Yeah, bars. Colleges, high schools would roll in and just, I mean, just like you're, and you would do it, you know, the crew goes in, sets up the gear, we go in, we do sound check, we have, you know, a lighting guy, sound guy, it's all,
right.
you know, you did all that stuff at a, not, you know, most bands weren't doing that, as in my opinion. I don't remember most bands doing that. But we were doing that. I stepped into that. I didn't have anything to do with building that aspect of it.
Oh, okay.
I just stepped in as the guitarist, you know, one of the guitarists.
Right.
Pat being the other one, of course.
Well, your manager eventually becomes Joel Miller.
Correct. That's right. Who
is a great historian on Facebook and, you know, has really provided me with a lot of the background information. So thank you, Joel.
Yes. Thank you, Joel. Joel's, you know, he was a really good promoter, not only just a supporter of the band, and he's always been a supporter of music, obviously, mm-hmm. but he worked really hard to raise the visibility of the band. And you know, I'm sure he had a lot to do with us playing some of the shows you were talking about at the Fieldhouse we played before Bachman Turner Overdrive and ZZ Top.
Right.
And we did a lot of college shows, and Joel was just, you know, driving force in, you know, believed in the band. And
any memories of those Fieldhouse shows? Did you meet the guys in ZZ Top or BTO at all? Or
I didn't meet those guys. No. I don't have any memories like that to share, but it was, you know, lots of fun. What, I'm sorry?
It was a long time ago.
A long time ago. I remember the shows. Sure. But we didn't meet them. It was all we could do to, you know, because those were even a step up from what we were trying to do. But, you know, we had a little preparation for that kind of thing. But that's on another level entirely, you know, right. you know, a touring act like that. But it gave us good experience and gave us, some perspective that probably helped us in, you know, maintaining that sort of that spectacle that you keep.
Sure. To. Yeah.
That probably helped us because we felt like we belonged.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was good for us. Yeah.
You know, Joel, one of the things that he talked about on this one Facebook post was, he said that you did a week-long appearance on the WQLN auction, and every day for 5 days straight, between 5 and 6 during the auction, they would cut to you guys performing one or two songs in the studio. Were you in the band then, or?
Yeah. You know, I may have been, but I don't okay. remember that. So,
all right. Yeah, he said it was May of 76. So,
wow. I don't know.
Yeah, I think Scott Campbell came in. Maybe a little bit later.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. The band then evolved. Pat and I were gone.
Right.
I do not remember that part of things. I mean, I remember being in the band. I remember not being in the band, But it, I don't recall, you know, why things changed and, you know, but they did. I honestly, I'm being honest. I don't remember if somebody quit or some, but it, you know, I sort of think that Pat had decided to move on, move out of the area.
Okay.
And I think that's what happened. And at that point for me, I thought Pat was, you know, pretty much the star of the band. I mean, everybody contributed and everybody, you know, had their little spots, but I thought Pat was the center of the thing with being the lead singer. I sang, but he was the lead singer. And with him leaving, if I'm remembering this right, that wasn't.
I think he went on to do ATV after that, right?
Well, yeah, you got me. I don't remember.
Yeah. And again, Joel is the historian on that. I think I've read that on some of his posts.
I would defer to Joel.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
you guys do record a 45, which a lot of people still have these days. You have a few of them too?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
So For a Change, which Pat wrote, and then Boogie, which you wrote, right?
Yeah, true. That's right.
All right. Have you listened to those songs in decades? Or
I haven't.
All right. I'm going to have to find some recordings of those.
Oh, goody.
I'll include those with your, on your episode page. I'll include some pictures of you in these bands over the years.
We didn't know what the hell we were doing. I don't, but you know, yeah, we did do that. Yeah.
What was there a plan to record more, like an album or anything, or was it just,
I don't remember that being discussed. I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. So eventually you do leave and that leads you to Reel to Reel, right?
Yes.
So now you're in Reel to Reel wearing some interesting outfits. You're wearing sort of the tuxes and more.
Yeah. I think that was the first, Reel to Reel went through a few different iterations. At one point it was, you know, at that time, you know, disco and that whole genre of music was just huge.
Yeah.
It was everywhere. And if you wanted to play live music, you were going to play that or you weren't going to work.
Sure.
And that was it. So there was a whole period there for a year or two. Seems like an eternity when that's the only work that could be had. So we would dress the way we needed to dress to get into the places that were available so we could continue to play music and continue to earn some money doing so. Right. And that's how that went. So Reel to Reel, it seems like that probably was how it started. I know at one point it was more of a rock band.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know if it started out that way and evolved into the disco or if the disco came first. I don't remember which came first.
I know,
but I would be inclined to think it started out as the disco and then got more rock.
Gotcha.
I'm not positive.
I saw that you played places like the Gaslight Lounge at the Liberty Plaza, Lord Beckwick, in the West Erie Plaza.
We did. And when we were playing there, we were playing more rock tunes.
You were. Okay.
So maybe it was that we started out that way and then those kind of gigs dried up.
Yeah. And
we switched to the, I should have probably looked up some of these dates so I could put things in the right order.
Well, I think I've got it right. And Joel also was helping manage the band at the time. Originally Bill Cotter's in the band, Denny Guzik's in the band for a little while. Dennis Cohen's in the band for a little while. Jeff Berger, obviously, and Jeff Toon. Eventually the band morphs into the core group of, and correct me, I think this is right, Mike Goodwin on keyboards, Steve McConnell on drums, you and Paul's on bass, and Ralph Lyons, he was like a singer from out of town.
He was with us for a while.
Okay.
Yeah, he was, I want to say he was from the Meadville area, but I may be mistaken. Okay. He was a really good singer.
Was that your first time playing with Paul Gall, who you still play with today?
Yeah, in that band. Yes. Paul and I have known each other for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you even played, the three of you, Steve played with you for a little while in Donnie. So that was, you had three of you guys there.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
We comprised most of the band, you know, the three of us. And we would, in that configuration, we would get ourselves booked into places like Holiday Inns, but they really wanted that. They really wanted dance music and disco music. So what we would do, you know, it would kind of conspire together, and we would learn songs that were disco songs. But then we'd take a whole section out of the middle of the song, and we would insert another song that we were more interested in playing, a song, you know, jazz rock stuff by Jeff Beck and Billy Cobham and Chick Corea, I'm sure, all of these types of bands. And we would insert that in after everybody was up on the dance floor, and we would keep them dancing because the tempos and the, you know, they didn't really know what it was that we were playing.
Right.
and that's how we would kind of get away with it. We would get our bookings because the song list would show all these songs that they recognized, but right. You know, they didn't really realize, but we kind of had to do that to keep our sanity. So we would just kind of extend the song. So instead of it being a, you know, a 4 minute song, it's just more like an 8 or 9 minute song with, you know, Jeff Beck in the middle of it.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Who were it, and that was good fun.
I'm sure, and
we were able to keep playing if we were to just do the disco stuff exclusively. I think, well, it would have just driven us crazy because it wasn't really the music that any of us wanted to play.
Yeah,
I'm not knocking it because there's some interesting good music that came out of that time and the people that wrote it. I mean, I have respect. It's just wasn't our style.
Sure. Right. Yeah. Right. You know. We mentioned Steve McConnell, and I interviewed him last year, and he mentioned in that episode that you and Mike Goodwin and he played in a short band called Opera. And you even remember that band?
And as a matter of fact, now when you're mentioning Steve, I also listened to Steve's.
His episode.
His episode too. Yeah. I'm recalling that now because you brought that up, and I remember him talking about Opera. And yeah.
Did you remember it before hearing that?
No, but I mean, I remember it having my memory jogged. I remember the band, and we had a very interesting selection. That was really kind of fun. Band. It would be, I know Steve said some good things about it, and I think he's right. It just, the band didn't, yeah, I don't know how popular we became. We just had a few places that we played, and it was, you know, music I'd never played before.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. We did play in that band together.
And around this time, 75, 76, you and I talked last time, you get your famous 75 Les Paul, right? You go to Manny.
Is it famous? Burger.
Is it famous? I don't know. Do you still play
it's
it?
It's right? Famous to me.
Yeah, it's famous to you. I mean, heck, you recorded, you know, that first album, right? With Donnie.
Oh,
right?
Yes. Still play it. Yes. It's still my main guitar. Yeah. And something happened. It gets better. I mean, yeah. These instruments, for some reason, and we could go talking about that as a whole subject in itself, but that 75 Les Paul, the wood is, you know, all, it's aged in a certain way. And I know it sounds kind of esoteric, but I have to tell you, it's really hard. I've recently bought a Les Paul to try and put the same pickups in, the same electronics. It's got the same wood in the neck, it's built relatively the same way, and I can't make it sound like that one. So I mean, I'm still playing it, and I use this other one, but I mean, it's, I think I'll have to invest in another, you know, let's see, 50 year old,
yeah,
in order to get the sound of a 50 year old Gibson.
Well, Scott Campbell said that he sold you a Les Paul in 1972. I imagine you don't have that one anymore.
He probably did, and I don't. the guitars that I parted with, that I wish I had now, I once had a 1951 gold top Les Paul.
Whoa.
51.
Wow.
and there aren't too many of them.
Yeah.
And I sold it for $500 for tuition money for college.
Oh, geez.
I just needed money, and I had this, and they weren't valued like they are now. Now, yeah, that's not the most valuable of the 50s Les Pauls, but trust me when I say it's worth,
I bet,
much more than $500 if I had it now. It was probably much more than $5,000. I don't even want to think about it. And there's many guitars like that. I wonder if Scott sold me a Firebird that I had.
He'll remember. I'll ask him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said tuition. So did you go to Barron for 4 years, or what'd you do?
No, just about a year and a half.
Right. And then you just played music.
I dropped out and started working.
Yeah.
You know, I just needed to work.
You were working enough playing music, right?
I wasn't working enough to pay my bills.
No? Okay. No. What was your regular job?
I worked at a couple of places in here. I worked at a place called Warren Radio, which is an electronics store on
I worked there too.
You did? You
worked there? I worked at Studio One, yeah.
Okay.
In the 80s, so a division, yeah.
Yeah,
so
I worked
there. Tim McLaughlin there.
Okay. I worked there when John Erickson worked there.
John Erickson worked there too. Yeah, I knew that. Yeah.
I worked at Warren Radio. I worked at a men's clothing store called P.A. Myers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just jobs.
Sure. Just jobs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what you got to do. Yeah. So eventually, and am I correct in our timeline here? You and Jeff and Bob leave to form the Fabulous Nobodies.
Yes.
78.
Yeah. Jeff Clare, Jeff Berger, Bob Berger, myself.
Now, at first, was Joey Celerino your drummer?
That could be, yes. Yeah. I stand corrected.
That's all right. No, I know Toon played with, you know, Bob pretty much for years, and we talked about that.
Yeah.
And
my bad. Of course, Joey was in it.
Yeah, I just talked to Joe.
Look, there's a whole lot of little iterations and bands of different members going in and out.
Oh, yeah.
It's fairly intricate time, you know, as you look at it and try and unpack it all. But yeah, definitely that's the case. It eventually became Jeff Toon Clare.
Right.
But yeah.
Becomes the Pulse. So you're eventually.
The Pulse.
Yeah.
Started out playing the stuff that you play in Holiday Inns,
mm-hmm,
to get work. Again, there was this era, and that's what we had to do.
Right.
So we were playing just popular songs on the radio and all of that. And we booked ourselves a string of shows in Florida, Lakeland, Florida, I don't know how many. And in those days, you'd play somewhere for a week or two, and you just set up and you'd play two or three or four nights, and that's what you'd do.
Okay.
And so we booked show down there, and whatever came over us, I don't know, but we had nothing really to do during the day, so we would go into the club. They'd allow us to go in there when no one was around, because it was rock club and, you know, dance club, so that there was nobody there all day long. And we go in and rehearse for hours, and we were learning new material and replacing the disco and dance stuff with rock tunes.
Ah, gotcha.
And we had that string of shows, however long we were down there, and we left the Erie area as like a pop dance top 40 band.
And this is still the Fabulous Nobodies, or is this the Pulse already?
And we changed the name midstream.
Oh, okay.
And I think we came back as the Pulse and came back as a rock band.
Okay.
And we still were doing covers, but we started to do some originals. We were doing Cheap Trick, and we actually, it was a pretty, really wide range of songs and material. We did stuff by Steely Dan. We did stuff by Cheap Trick. We did stuff by Bruce Springsteen, Elvis Costello. We did all of that. And that was not the material we were doing when we left.
Right.
We came back with that. And we just kind of, you know, the way I remember, we just said, okay, we're a rock band now.
I saw a picture of, there's like five guys, and I think Dickie Buckle was in the band, like on a slide.
Dickie played some shows. And
somebody said that slide picture was in Florida. So I assumed it was on this tour.
Yeah. Going down. Yeah. I don't remember how long that lasted, but okay. Yeah, he was around. Great guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
He was around. But we came back and it was a different thing. And then that's all we did was we and Bob Berger's a terrific songwriter. So we started, you know, doing his material. So we converted to a band that did original material, that being Bob's,
right.
And all these rock tunes, you know, Springsteen and all this stuff. And we completely reconfigured the thing. That was a fun time. And that, because we played a lot, and then we started, because we were that, we started being able to do opening shows for the Iron City House Rockers and Blue Angel, which was Cyndi Lauper's band, and the Artful Dodger, which was another, you know, sort of indie type, bubbling under type band. And gosh, they're probably others. I don't remember them all.
It's funny. Yeah, I read something where a reviewer was saying exactly what you said. Like, they had reviewed you like a year before, and then they came back and they're like, yeah, this is a different band now. Like, they're way tighter and they're way more poppy and stuff like that. And
somebody else may remember it differently, but I remember it as we left as one kind, and we spent a lot of time. It's not like we just, you know, snapped our fingers. We worked at it.
Right.
We spent our days developing, and I don't remember why we decided to do that. I have no idea what the plan was. But when we came back, we were different. And then all the shows got different, and we started getting opening things. Dennis Cohen was our manager.
Right.
And he worked really hard to get us these opening shows, and we got in front of people, and we got into the Agora in Cleveland and the Decade in Pittsburgh. And all of a sudden we were like a fairly visible regional band of some note.
And then you release You Want to Know Why, or?
Yeah. During that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was in that time. And we also, and I don't remember how this came about, but maybe Bob remembers, but he's got a better memory than I do.
He covered a lot of it in his episode. You're right. Yeah.
And I haven't listened to his yet. Okay. And so if I'm, redundant here.
That's all right.
At least this way you've got credible information. It's been.
That's right. Two sides of the story.
We ended up getting, I think we were submitting tapes of Bob's songs to, all over the place. And there was a point at which Ed C, who was a producer in Atlanta, heard one of our demos.
Okay.
And ended up, we were invited down there to record, and they produced two or three songs, and they were going to shop them around for us. We were at that point, we were kind of focused on trying to get a record deal.
Okay.
And so the band, you know, was doing the live performances, but Bobby was writing, really, I call him Bobby, he goes by Bob now, but he was writing, you know, a lot, and we weren't shy about putting his songs in the sets. And it, although, you know, it's tough. You know, people want to hear a hit song by Bruce Springsteen. They don't necessarily want to hear a song they don't know about. But over time, people started to, you know, come to our shows, and they wanted to hear those the songs that
the Springsteen medley that you guys did.
Well, that too, but they wanted to hear our songs.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Right.
Is what happened. And we had it was an eclectic, I guess, mix of material, because if you're doing, we did a song by Weather Report, which is, you know, not anything like Elvis Costello, but we would do Elvis Costello, and then we would do you know, I mentioned Cheap Trick, and we would do Steely Dan, and God, we would do songs from the 60s by Moby Grape and The Music Machine. Talk Talk was a great song for us live. You play all these, you know, unusual songs.
Yeah, you started with Omaha usually, right? From Moby Grape.
Yes. Gosh, it's true. From Moby Grape.
Yeah, he talked about that. It's a killer song.
People who knew music found, I think they found the band pretty entertaining, because it's not, you're going to be out there listening to a lot of bands before you hear somebody play that song.
Right, right.
You know.
I think Bob said that Joe Grushecki years later had said, you know, he really loved it when you guys opened with that song, and he always remembered it, and it was one of his favorites.
Yeah, that sounds like Joe, and yeah.
So you're playing in the Pulse, and the Pulse is really a short-lived band. It's together in some way, shape, or form in a couple of years. You record the album. You're getting played on radio all the time.
Not an album, but songs.
I'm sorry. Right. You're right.
Yeah.
Two songs. And then one night you're playing and some skinny guy with glasses comes to see you, right? And that changes everything.
Yeah. We were playing down in New Brighton, PA, at a club called Maury's Speakeasy. I don't think it was the first time we played there. It was just one of the sort of regional places that we played, you know, medium-sized kind of rock bar club thing. We played many, many places. Many, all over the tri-state area. And guy came up and, you know,
did you know Donnie?
Introduced himself. I didn't know who he was at all. And he introduced himself and he said, you know, I'm doing an album, you know, do you think you'd like to, you know, play on the album? And you know, I said, yeah, well, sure. You know, but the thing is, at that time, and still, you know, people come up to you with, and who knows who they really are, what they really have going on, but they a lot of times pretend that they have things going on. They don't. And so I basically didn't believe him.
Right.
But he gave me his phone number and I gave him mine. And I didn't think a whole lot about it, because there was a friend of mine named Rick Witkowski, which we didn't really talk about that part of things, but Rick would.
Oh, I wanted to get to that because you offered to join Crack the Sky.
Well, yeah, well, I was offered to audition.
Right,
audition. And I did, and that went really well. But then the guitar player that was going to leave Crack the Sky decided not to leave.
Ah, okay.
And I'd gone all the way down to Weirton, West Virginia, and auditioned, and Paul Gall came with me, actually. Hmm. And I don't remember exactly where that was in the flow of things, but Rick Witkowski and I stayed in touch. And then Rick, I remember talking to him and I told him, we were just talking because we talked as friends. And I said, yeah, I met this guy, Donnie Iris. And he says, Donnie Iris, you met him? I said, yeah. And I told him what had happened. He said, well, you should be pretty excited about that. Now, this was before our first album. Right. So all he knew about Donnie was him being in the Jaggers and being in Wild Cherry, and he knew he was really talented.
Sure.
Because that's what he had accomplished up to that point, which is no small feat.
Right.
Okay. He was a fairly big deal. But he wasn't Donnie Iris, the rock and roll guy that he became, right?
Right.
But he said, you should be excited at it. That should be fun. And I don't know who called who. Then I took it a little bit more seriously because Rick had said I should. And then Donnie, he's a very kind of down to earth guy that doesn't plan a lot of things. Good things just happen to him. It's the way he is. And for him, Mark and he had been in Wild Cherry and wanted to do some work together and wanted to write, maybe do a record. And they were writing and they were starting to record some demos, but they weren't settled on the band. They knew they wanted to use Kevin Valentine on drums because Mark had played with him in Breathless. Kevin's really terrific. And they'd heard about this bass player from Youngstown named Al Britton McLean, who also had this giant reputation, you know, and well-deserved. And they didn't have a guitar player. Now, they knew guitar players, but for whatever, I have no idea why, they weren't settled on it. Just wasn't, they weren't ready to commit to anyone. Mm-hmm. So as far as I understand, Donnie just, you know, which is would be his way, just said, well, I'll see if I can go hear somebody play. So the Morey Speakeasy is probably 3 miles from his house at the time. And he just drove down to the rock club that he would be nearby and came in, and we just happened to be there. And that was about as complicated as it was. And, you know, lucky for me, in terms of that opportunity, we played such a wide variety of songs that anybody that would come and see the band that would hear, whether they were making a kind of a observation about the keyboard player or the singer or the guitar player, they would hear somebody doing all kinds of music. So they would have to conclude, you know, because Bob Berger would sing these Elvis Costello songs and he'd sing Bruce Springsteen. Those two, so they're nothing alike, you know, and right. He'd do all these things in his original. So if you were going to hear our band, you'd conclude, well, this guy can sing anything, which he kind of can.
Yeah, yeah.
And the same way with guitar playing, because I'd have to play all these different styles and the Pretenders, and they're all different, you know, radically different. So it was good from a showcase standpoint.
Right. Which you didn't realize that's what it was.
Yeah. So he was able to make a decision fairly quickly because, well, this guy's really good. I don't know what I'm going to be asking him to do, but he just looks like he could do pretty much whatever I ask him. I would presume he thought something along that line.
Yeah.
And so then that whole, you know, sort of chapter start began. And then I recorded and would go to Beaver Falls and we would record. And we were just doing tracks. The way that the band records always did was we would do tracks and then the vocals would go on top of that. The songs would be built within the studio.
Okay.
You wouldn't really know what the song was going to be like. Even if I'm talking about Aaliyah, it was just the chords, the bass and drums and guitar. And that's all it was. When I left the studio, I'm going, well, you know, it's kind of a, you know, kind of heavy rocked out tune, but I had no idea. And the vocals are such a big part of that. When I came back to play a guitar solo, I was like, oh my gosh, really? You know, because I didn't expect, well, a lot of people didn't expect that. It was kind of a novel song at the time when it came right. out. But anyway, that's how that went. So I had to, as that album got finished, I was still playing with Pulse. Everything was fine. You know, we were just doing, we were trying to get a record deal. And that, I didn't really give it a lot of thought. But what happened was then, you know, while I'm playing in the Pulse, that whole record took on a sort of a life of its own, and it was being promoted and all of that. And there was not originally a thought to having a band or anything. They just wanted to do this record. But because of Aaliyah, it got a lot of attention and then some, you know, because radio stations were starting to pick it up. And then I started getting phone calls and they're saying, look, you know, there's a lot going on here. Is this something you'd be interested in? And so, you know, I had some hard decisions to make because, you know, I love the guys in Pulse.
Sure.
Bob, you know, like my best friend.
Right.
So leaving that was not an easy decision, and it was tough, you know, but you know, that's how that went.
And that was the end of your Erie music days.
End of my Erie music days. Although, you know, as time went on and I would come off the road and maybe not have any tour dates for several months, I would find things to do. And I would sometimes play with some other friends. Most notably my friends, Rick Scandalberry and David Blates and Matt, I'm trying to think of Matt's last name. Anyway, we had a little band called, was it Abstract Cats or was it something else?
I remember that name. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we had a little duo with Rick Scantlebury too, as Abstract Cats, but I can't remember what we used to call ourselves, but we would play.
Albert of India?
Or yes. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right.
Why wouldn't I think of that name, right?
That's a crazy name.
Yeah. Albert of India. So we would play, I would, you know, when I could, so that I could still play, you know, and they were really good musicians. And
sure.
Did that. I also played some, and I don't remember where this took. I played, you know, with some friends, a band called the Blues. I think it was the Blues Beaters or something like that. It was a blues band with
sure. Kevin. They're still around today. They're still around, still
Kevin
playing.
And at the time it was Ed Burnick and myself. I'm not going to remember everybody, but.
No. Yeah.
And it would, I think it would change, be different guys in the band at one. And I would play in there doing some blues tunes. So what was the end of my eerie sort of regular playing, but still got a chance to do that.
So over the years, obviously you play with Donnie for all those years. Do you ever get back to Erie much? Do you have any family here anymore? Or?
My sister and her family
are
in Erie, and that's the only family I have in Erie.
Okay.
And, I don't get back very often. I'm thinking about it this year, actually.
Well, Bob's coming in on July 1st to play with Dickie. So.
Yeah, I'm going to, yes, I'm aware of that. And he's coming out this way and to visit me, and I'm going to see him on the 4th.
And 20 years ago, had the heart attack on stage. Everything good?
Everything's good.
Since? No, good. No,
yeah, it was good. It was, yes.
That was a weird gig. I was there. Yeah.
Were you there? Yeah, that was really poor form on my part. I apologize for that. It ruined everybody's evening. I was well taken care of there, and I have been ever since. So, you know, I play with no problems.
How often do you play these days with Donnie?
Yeah, once a month.
Oh, okay.
You know, something like that. We're playing, I don't think there's anything on the calendar. August 6th. We're playing with Journey at the NFL Hall of Fame celebration, which is in Canton. So it's pretty much my second hometown.
Yeah, right.
Canton. Yeah. So we're playing with Journey on the 6th of August. And then on the 10th of September, we play with REO Speedwagon. Who are the names? Loverboy.
Okay.
And I think Styx. I believe.
Yeah.
At the Star Lake Amphitheater in Pittsburgh.
That's nice.
September 10th.
Yeah.
We either do our own shows, you know, around this area. We don't travel now. It's just we could travel, we could get some people in, we could have a good time, but it's hard to make the numbers work. As it is, we typically fly in Paul from South Carolina.
Right.
And we fly in Kevin from LA and fly them in and put them up. I mean,
it's a lot.
You know,
yeah.
It adds a lot to the budget, you know, so,
right.
You know, it gets expensive, and to multiply that by everybody else and then go out on the road like we used to do, you know, we just can't make the numbers work. So.
Well, I'll make sure on your episode page to put a link to, you know, Donnie's site where folks can find you these days. But yeah, I'll make sure I get those pictures up there and everybody can see what you looked like back in the day and come see you these days out there playing with all those other folks.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Chip.
Thanks, Marty. This has been great. And everybody in your hometown is proud of you. And, you know, I appreciate you talking to me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Take care.
My thanks to Bob Berger for putting me in touch with Marty this time. And my thanks to you for listening. Make sure to hit the subscribe and like buttons on your podcast app. This is the last episode of season 3, and I'm going to be taking off the summer before starting season 4 in the fall. Thanks to the JPT Foundation for their ongoing financial support and for the monthly free music night that we host at their hall featuring the local band, The Fabulous Leftovers, not related to the Fabulous Nobodies that Marty was in. We hold those music events the last Tuesday of every month, so watch for that. You can support the podcast via Venmo or Patreon. Just click on the Support This Podcast link on the homepage for more information. And for more information on what bands or musicians are playing in Erie and the surrounding area, please check out Jack Stevenson's Two Man Happy Hour podcast and webpage. Two Man Happy Hour. Check that out. So I'm Chip Shell, your host, and I'll be back in the fall of 2022 with new episodes. In the meantime, get out there and support live local music. Take care.